Welcome to the Writing for a Living podcast, where I interview writers of all kinds. And today I'm talking to Eben Matthews, who is a writer, producer, and founder of Macroverse. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Carly. Glad to be here.
And how did you get into writing, and how did you get to where you are now, kind of building Macroverse?
Yeah, so I mean, if you find our episode from before, well, you know, it's more kind of focused on the overall journey to starting this company and kind of what we're trying to build as an ecosystem for creators and all the cool stuff we're doing inside the Macroverse. But I think for the purpose of this conversation and your question, keeping it a little more writing focused, so I actually started as an illustrator. You know, my passion for comics goes back to being, you know, kind of before I could read. Like, I very clearly remember learning to read from comic books, pulling comics off the spinner rack at you know, gas stations and you know, kind of any place that you would find them before there was a real, you know, kind of direct market in the way that there is now. And so, you know, I just grew up with that as part of the fabric of my childhood. You know, I fell in love with that medium, and I've been drawing since I was 2 years old. So I think I'm one of the few people whose parents talked them out of going to law school to go to art school instead. and so I didn't initially see myself as a writer. I thought I would be someone that would be, you know, working with a writer to develop material visually and doing the kind of the drawing part of making comics. When I came out of art school, I segued into starting my first company, which was a branding and media agency. And so we were kind of at the height of when Flash was taking over the web, and that meant, you know, everything was very interactive and animated, and as kind of this early days of the internet. And so that led me to doing a little bit of still very much focused on the art and creative side, but I had to start being able to interface with directors and production companies and agencies and, you know, our clients. And so we would end up being more a part of the kind of collaboration on the, what is the story? How do we tell the story? You know, how do we, you know, make this sequence of images, you know, create the kind of impact that we wanted to create. And then I, you know, even though I wouldn't have said that was writing, it was very much kind of headed in that direction of figuring out, you know, the storytelling piece beyond just the visual side. But sometimes what is the dialogue for these characters, or, you know, who are these characters in the context of this story that we're trying to tell? And that led to working on children's books. You know, we did some children's books for Target. We produced a couple of animated pilots with a Korean partner, and that I did have a lot of input on the script on. We had an animated series, which we were pitching at that point, where I developed like the whole story Bible for it. And so kind of slowly but surely kind of, you know, moving in that direction, even though I didn't really quite identify, you know, as a writer at that point. And so really the turning point where I went from being really an artist who kind of participated in story to now kind of being both a writer and an artist is that, I met my co-founder in Macroverse, who was coming up in film and television. So when we met, he was working on Transformers, the first Transformers movie. And you got to kind of put yourself in this moment in time where we're in kind of a post Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, Kevin Smith, you know, Hollywood. And for us, we had this kind of revelation one night together, you know, might've been a couple of drinks involved. And we said, you know, we're just going to be making stuff for other people for the rest of our lives, and we want to be on the other side of that equation. And so the energy in the independent film world at that point was so palpable as people that wanted to tell stories, that wanted to make content. And so, you know, it became very clear, like, write a screenplay, you know, become famous directors. That was the that was the goal at that point. And so we did. We wrote a screenplay. Adam had actually written a couple, you know, prior to that, that had just, you know, been sample scripts. You know, I had been dabbling in, you know, more of the comic side of things, but also kind of writing some stuff, you know, separately. And so we came together and we wrote this first screenplay together, and that one got optioned. And so it gave us the, you know, the confidence to say, okay, like, let's really try to push in this direction. And so we ended up at one of the big talent agencies and, you know, pitching a bunch of different stories and TV show ideas and movie ideas. We had a TV pilot that we ended up writing that got really close to moving forward. I'm going to turn off my notifications here. And then, you know, when that TV pilot literally got killed by The Walking Dead, which we could get into as its own story, we segued into the video game world. And our first project in gaming was writing all the story content for, you know, a fighting game, essentially. So it's this big console game, kind of underground cage fighting. And what was so fascinating about that is we actually got hired to produce all of the cutscenes for this game. So it's about 90 minutes of content that went into this game. And part of that contract was for us to write all the scripts. And so we, you know, ended up creating this really interesting process where many of the fighters in the game, even though they were fictionalized, were based on real UFC or kind of underground fighters, you know, known people. And so we ended up kind of learning how to talk to and interview these real people and then kind of take inspiration from their stories, or in a few cases, make them, you know, quite autobiographical, and then integrate that into these narrative, you know, threads that you would follow each of these characters through the game. And so I think for me, like, that was really that experience. You know, we worked on that game for probably close to a year, putting all that together by the time it was all said and done. And then we ended up doing a spinoff into a mobile version of it. And I think by the time we got through with that, like, for me, that was really the period where I was like, okay, I can really embrace this kind of label as, you know, kind of seeing myself not just as an artist who kind of has a good story sense and, you know, a good, you know, kind of handle on how, you know, some story plays out, but really, you know, being a writer as well, like turning in scripts, understanding more about the craft, like, what does that mean? And then what that's led to is, yeah, actually, at this point in my career, I do more writing than I do art, where, you know, I've now been able to kind of put writers' rooms together for different projects, working with a lot of different artists, where I've actually found this kind of interesting sweet spot for myself, where I care so much about the way these worlds that we're building and these franchises that we're building, you know, inside of our company ultimately develop, that I end up putting more attention at this point on, you know, how is this all constructed? How is this going to play out? What are these stories that we're telling? And then finding really amazing artists to be able to collaborate with to come in and bring those stories to life. So I'll shut up there, but that's been the kind of the evolution into the writing world.
I have a few questions from that. So the first one is, you had talked about how maybe it's a bit different from doing something independently, like something that you want to do, or, you know, you kind of do write for an audience, obviously, you know, you want them to like your work, but you don't want to be writing stuff that you don't feel good about, or maybe that's not what you want to do. And is there this kind of thing where you pitch to maybe bigger publishers, but they don't take some of the independent stuff? So is there a balance there? Or do you think that more writers should be maybe open to doing and publishing independently?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's two, I'm going to answer that in two different ways. I think number one, we are in a moment in time where there's never been more opportunity to publish your own work, to put your own work out there in many different ways. And there's a little bit of a double-edged sword there. One is there's literally no barrier to putting work out and getting feedback from an audience. You know, often that comes with zero revenue, $0 for that initially. But I think, you know, that's true kind of no matter what you're going into as a creative, especially like you start, you know, making stuff, and whether it's, you know, in the old days, you would write a spec pilot for a TV show or a spec, you know, script for a movie, and you're not getting paid for that. You're doing that as an example of, you know, the work that you can do. Now you're kind of doing the same thing, but you can get direct feedback from, you know, people that are going to be experiencing this thing that you've created. And so that can be really valuable in helping you hone in on what people respond to. The other way that I would answer that, though, is that, you know, kind of, I'm not sure if this is kind of the neighborhood you're getting into, but it's what occurs to me is that I think a lot of people, especially early in their career, and I think it's interesting, I think this maps both into being a visual artist and being a writer, that a lot of people, you know, get very hung up on like how to find your own voice, how to find your own style. Like, how do I make this something that's uniquely mine, but still appeals to a audience, if that's what you're, you know, interested in, which I am. I kind of unabashedly want people to like the stuff that I make. So, you know, I think the balance there is looking at it from the visual side. I've mapped this into my work as a writer, where, you know, I got the best advice of my art career from one of my mentors, who's a, you know, phenomenal comic artist named Brian Stallfreeze. And when I was going to art school, Brian said, you know, if you, I got all these influences as a comic artist. It was very derivative of other artists when I was going into art school. And, you know, I'll just shout out, like, my guy was a guy named Art Adams. If I could have been Art Adams, that would have made my life complete at that moment in time. And Brian said to me, look, just set all that aside. You're going into, you know, one of the best art schools in the country. Like, just take advantage of being there. Everything you're going in with will be there for you when you leave. And we got into a conversation about style. And this is what he said. And I think this has now become the thing that I tell young artists. You actually can't find your style by trying to find your style. I think the same thing is true with your voice as a writer. Your style is your way of seeing the world. And so when you think about that as a visual artist, like, let's say the assignment I always give young artists that I've, you know, mentored over the years is draw 100 hands. So your hand, a human hand, is one of the hardest things on the planet to draw. Like, this machine of what this thing is very challenging to put into three-dimensional space, to understand how fingers work, to understand how you hold things, all the different things that your hand can do. So kind of, you know, immersion therapy, if you will, like drawing 100 hands. By the time you're done drawing 100 hands, number one, you'll have a very good sense of how to draw a hand. And if you can draw a hand, you can pretty much draw anything. And more importantly, from a style conversation, if you're looking at something real and trying to draw it realistically, then you're never going to draw it realistically. Even people that draw what we think, you know, photoreal art or paint or, you know, anything that we think of as photoreal, it's still not photoreal. It's still their slight interpretation on reality. And so, you know, in the visual sense, the way you interpret reality by putting those marks on a page, that's your style. And so, you know, you can certainly evolve over time to, you know, find your own different types of interpretations. But I think when you step away from trying to emulate someone else's art and you find your own viewpoint into what you see in the world, that's your style. And so how that maps into writing is it's your personal experiences. It's, you know, how you understand what sadness is or happiness is, or, you know, what it feels like to try to accomplish something, you know, these journeys that we want characters to go on over the course of the stories that we tell have to come from our own personal experience in some way for them to ring true to the people that are reading them or are experiencing them. We want that emotional connection, which is where we fall in love with characters and stories. And so I think the only place we have to draw on for that is our own personal experience. And then we can extrapolate that into everything from, you know, a small character piece to the largest sci-fi, fantasy, horror, you know, whatever. But with that emotional kind of center to it, where you can feel it as the creator, ideally that's going to translate to the person that's experiencing it as a consumer.
And with the, you know, with taking like the art portion and with the writing, and sometimes it might feel like, okay, if you're the writer, then it's your job to come up with a story, and then you might think, oh, I'm going to hire an artist or something, but really it might be the opposite, where you're actually building a team and like you're all collaborating together because you want the art to tell the story too, right? Like,
yeah, for sure.
It's a huge part of it. So how do you kind of go about that? Maybe like finding the right team or making sure that all kind of comes together.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we're talking about comics specifically, and then I think you can extrapolate this to, you know, games and other things as well. But, you know, I think for comics, one thing that's unique about comics is it tends to be a pretty small team. Often it's, you know, 2 to 3 people. So, you know, writer, artist, sometimes colorist, you know, occasionally there's a penciler or then an inker, you know, that take on these different roles. But generally it's a, you know, 3, maybe a 2 to 5 person team kind of at the most. And people come into that process in different ways. Comics is one of the most interesting creative industries because there's no playbook for how people make comics. You know, in movies and television, it's very like, this is the format for a film script. This is the way that a, you know, a TV show works. Like there's a lot, there's so many people and so much money at stake, you know, that those processes are very, you know, some wiggle room, but very, you know, standardized. In comics, you'll see 10 different scripts from 10 different writers, and they look totally different. Some people write, you know, very, very brief descriptions of a, you know, a full page might be three sentences, and then it's handed off to the artist to, you know, interpret that, bring it to life in, you know, visual storytelling, and then they hand it back to the writer who then puts the word balloons in and scripts, you know, those pages. It's, you know, going all the way back to the 60s, the quote unquote Marvel method was, you know, Stan Lee literally, you know, debatable to what degree, but, you know, giving sort of plot or outline to his artists, they would go draw the whole comic, hand it back to him, and he would then go in and fill in all the dialogue. So that was, you know, kind of the Marvel method. And then in the kind of post 90s, it got to be very in vogue for people to write full scripts, essentially screenplays, you know, for comics. And then there's everything in between. And I kind of fall somewhere in between when it comes to, you know, writing comics, where when I'm writing comics, I tend to think very visually. And I think that is because I have kind of the art background as well. So I'm kind of thinking of like, if I was drawing this, how would I do it? But the real job writing comics, right? Even this applies to writing film and TV too. The script is not the finished product. It's a communication tool to your collaborators. And so, you know, when I'm writing for another artist in particular, the way I think about that is like, my job is to tell them, what do they need to know to try to capture the thing that's in my head as much as possible? And then when you've got great collaborators, as soon as you've done that job to say like, here's what I'm thinking, here's how this plays out, here's how this story works, here's who these characters are and the journey that we're taking them on. As soon as you've communicated that, then I think my job is to get out of the way. So, you know, what I never want my collaborators to feel is, I've got this great idea and I can't do it because the script is something different. And so I'll use, you know, we work with this amazing artist named Stephen Perkins on our series called Dead Town. And, you know, what we learned working with Stephen very early on is that he would take the script, and these scripts are pretty detailed. Like, I, you know, there are times when, you know, it's like we're in this post-apocalyptic world. There's this sequence that takes place in season two, spoiler alert, where, you know, there's this kind of big arena sequence in this broken down, what used to be this kind of large parking garage. It's kind of been turned into this, you know, a fighting arena in this post-apocalyptic world. And so I, you know, wrote probably two paragraphs describing like, you know, how do I see this working? Like, you know, how is this part of the world constructed? How have they turned this thing into this, you know, arena and all that? And that's an example where, you know, he basically took that, interpreted it, did a, you know, pretty much exactly what I had put on the page, but it was because I had given him like all that information. And then there are other times where even at that level of detail, he'll come back and go like, I've got a better idea. It should be this. And sometimes that's a conversation. Sometimes it's just him delivering the art back. And, you know, it's just, I really want to give the people that I work with the freedom to, you know, bring their own vision, their own voice to it. So we're telling the same story. And all that matters to me is that we ultimately get to the place that, you know, we're trying to get to with bringing people on this journey that we're trying to bring them on. And then there are times where, you know, I'd say the majority of the time with all the artists that we work with, when they come back with something different, their response is like, amazing. Like, we didn't think of that. That's awesome. Here's how we can adjust the script so that it, you know, lines up perfectly. And then there are occasional times where you'll get something back and go like, you know, what I failed to tell you is that this matters three episodes from now. And so we do actually need that to be yellow, not red, you know, or something like that. So I think you have to kind of choose, you know, the things that matter and the things that don't. But where I think especially new people can get into trouble in this kind of collaborative process is getting too attached to it being this particular way. And the spirit of collaboration that I've always found really works. And, you know, Adam, who I mentioned earlier, you know, he and I have been writing partners now for, you know, 20 years. And the thing we've had to learn with each other and then apply across, you know, our other collaborators is that if we aren't agreeing on something, you know, our philosophy has become, it means we haven't found the right idea. It's not that my idea is right or his idea is right. It's that there's a third idea we haven't hit on yet, which is actually the right thing. And so I think we try to apply that to everyone that we work with, is that the best idea is ultimately going to win. It's not about ego. It's not about my vision versus your vision. It's about finding the thing that we all go, oh my God, that's it. Like, let's go there. Yeah.
I'm glad you said that though, because I'm going to show this to somebody, because I've been working on writing something with somebody else. Like, we're partnering on it, and we looked at all these different, you know how you can get comic books and at the back there's like shows kind of the process, and we're like, are we doing this wrong? We're writing, it's like we're writing a book.
Right.
Okay. We got like all so much going on, but no, I think we're good now. But
yeah.
Yeah. So you're like, what is the actual structure to this? Like, what have people done before? And, but yeah, we're like just writing everything down and putting it all together, but it kind of is coming across as, maybe like you'd say a screenplay or a book or something. And we're like, is this too much? We don't know, but we're just winging it at this point.
I think winging it is a great place to start. And then I think, you know, if you've got, you know, I don't know if you'll ultimately have an artist or if you already have an artist on board, but it's like, I think that the important thing is just when that person comes in to just feel, to have everybody feel that they really have the opportunity to have a voice, to have a piece of, you know, how it plays out. And that, you know, I think the only bad experiences I've had with artists have been where someone has gotten too prescriptive about, you know, the way that, you know, something has had to be. And, you know, we've had a couple of challenges with, you know, clients occasionally where it's like, you know, oh, you know, I really need that to be, you know, a sunset sky, and you a sunset sky. And then they're like, well, I meant for it to be like, you know, 20% more pink. And then you're like, okay, make it 20% more pink. You're like, that's not pink enough. Like, so, you know, again, there are times when those details matter, but more often than not, it's best to just let your collaborators, you know, kind of do the work that they do. Yeah.
And you said you had done game writing. Like, how does, like, there's so much different forms of writing. Like, how does that differ from, you know, something else that you're doing? And is there, I'm sure there's like, it's all transferable skills, right? Because it's all writing, but like, how is it different working on different projects?
Yeah, so I mean, to me, the core of all of it, and you know, here's the one thing, the one medium I have never tried to do is like long form prose. Like, I've never tried to write a book. You know, I've written just about everything else, at least in the media world. So, you know, I think to me, like, the real core of all of it is we need to bring people on some sort of a journey. Like, at the very, you know, fundamental level, like, you know, we do a thing within Macroverse where we, you know, we teach kind of storytelling 101, you know, I won't call them classes necessarily, but we kind of bring people on this kind of, how do you think about telling stories in the context of our company with the characters that you're kind of bringing to the table. And so, you know, the way we generally start those sessions is that, you know, this is the first concept for people to wrap their heads around, is that character is always the thing that's driving the plot, and plot is never the thing that's driving the characters. And you can see this in movies that, you know, you really love versus ones that are kind of like, eh, where, you know, it's like, you know, if you're seeing a movie, and even if it's like beautiful and spectacular and the visual effects are amazing, but it kind of just leaves you flat, more often than not, it's because you don't really care about the characters. Like, they just went on this sequence of events, and like, you know, this thing led to that thing, led to this thing. And that's kind of a, you know, the plot driving the characters. And what you really want is, you want your characters to have some unquenchable need that they, you know, are after, that they, you know, have to accomplish something. And this can apply to, you know, Lord of the Rings, or it could apply to, you know, Steel Magnolias. Like, it's, you know, it's not genre specific, but it's like, we all want things. We all are trying to accomplish something. And the best conflicts come from, I'm trying to accomplish X and you're trying to accomplish Y, and therefore we're butting heads. And that could be Thanos versus the Avengers, or it could be, you know, Forrest Gump, you know, trying to figure out his place in the world. So, you know, it's really about coming back to having an understanding of, these characters want these things, that creates some sort of conflict and journey that they need to go on to try to accomplish those things. And more often than not, they're going to end up in a different place at the end of the story than they started. That's the kind of evolution or the arc, you know, of the character, and that drives the evolution and the arc of the story. And then when it comes to writing in different mediums, I think that with that kind of fundamental framework, at least the way I approach these things, then it becomes about really trying to understand the strength of the particular medium that you're working in. And so I think where people sometimes struggle when they're, you know, I write screenplays and now I'm trying to write a game, or, you know, I write comics and now I'm trying to write a movie. It's like, yes, these are, there are different format elements or different ways of executing these things, which are going to be different. And so getting an understanding of, you know, what those things are is, you know, certainly important. But what I try to do is really figure out, like, what are the strengths of the medium? What are the weaknesses of the medium? How do we lean into those strengths as much as possible, instead of trying to force something that works really well in a show, in a game, in a, you know, film script, into a game, or trying to force something that works really well in a comic into an audio, you know, series. And so, you know, as a quick example, like, audio is a great one. We've created, you know, a number of narrative audio shows at this point. And so when you're writing for audio, like, you know, obviously the very first thing is, like, there are no visuals to accompany this. And so even thinking about the type of story that you're telling, how you're telling it, like, you have to be thinking about what can someone hear that brings them through this, that helps tell the story, where you're not just having characters, you know, explain what's happening, you know, throughout the entire thing. So how do you use that, you know, the fact that you don't have a visual to bring people through that experience in a unique and interesting way? And so, you know, again, kind of leaning into the strengths rather than trying to force it to be something that it's not.
That brings me to character, like, when you said character drives the plot. Mm-hmm. Before I had a chat with you today, this morning I talked to Jordan Thomas, who wrote Weird Work, and Frank at Home on the Farm, and Man, I think it's Man from Maybe. Hopefully I'm not getting that wrong. But we had somehow talked about There Will Be Blood, the movie.
Sure.
Yeah. and that made me think about that, and, like, that's one of my favorite movies, and it really is, it draws you into the characters, because there's so much internal conflict going on, and you know, within the movie there's, like, the oil guy, and then there's the preacher, and they're both kind of the same, or they're both striving for power, but they're doing it in opposite ways, and there's, like, a lot going on within the characters' lives. So I wanted to ask you, like, when you're thinking about characters and developing characters, is there a process to that? Or do you kind of, like, think about a character and write it down and, like, go into their lives? Or, like, you know, do you have any suggestion for people for that?
Yeah. Man, yes and no, I guess, is the answer to that. So I'll give you two examples. So for Dead Town, you know, Dead Town is this comic series that we make that's out now. That is actually the pilot script that we wrote, you know, 15 years ago that got killed by The Walking Dead. So we brought it back as a graphic novel series a couple of years ago. But in that, like, we did go through a pretty extensive development process. Like, we actually have a 90-page world Bible for Dead Town that includes, you know, all the main characters, how the whole world works. Like, it's, you know, it's a zombie apocalypse, so how are our zombies different than other zombies? Like, what's the dynamics of the whole world? Who are all the different factions that exist in this world? So there's a very detailed, you know, kind of structure to, you know, what we then build these stories on top of. There's another series that I'm just starting writing, which people will see more of this year, for a project that we have called The Vogu. And The Vogu is also this kind of future sci-fi fantasy world where humanity has had to leave Earth. And, you know, it's this semi-dystopian, but the basic function, the basic concept is that now humans live in these kind of interstellar, you know, kind of ships, these kind of dormitories, and they're able to kind of tether their consciousness into these robot bodies if they want to go on Earth or, you know, go to other places in the galaxy. And so they have kind of their human lives and their kind of robot adventures in a sense. And so, you know, we're just starting to kind of build that out. Now, and in this case, like I'm both writing the series and kind of developing it at the same time because I don't want to spend the time to create a 90-page Bible for it. And we have a kind of general sense of the world and, you know, all of that. And so, you know, with that one, I think, you know, we're playing it a little more loosey-goosey where I know who the main characters are and I have a pretty clear sense in my mind of kind of their attitude and what they want. And like, I think those kind of fundamental questions that I think do have to be answered going into something like this, and it will evolve over time without question, but knowing, you know, and in this case, it's both individual characters and kind of groups of characters where it's like, you know, they have this particular objective. And then within that larger objective, here's these kind of core set of characters and she wants this and he wants that. And so having that kind of general sense of who are these characters, what do they want, how do they express themselves. And then this kind of goes back to what we're talking about earlier. All of those characters in one way or another are me. So, you know, when it's like I'm writing, you know, I'm writing the person that we've met who may or may not be the leader of the kind of semi-rebellion in this world. It's like, you know, that's me trying to strive for some aspect of my personality that thinks that, you know, we should not be so consumed with material things and, you know, should be more oriented around, you know, our own humanity and less concerned about technology. And like, you know, I can kind of channel those thoughts and ideas, you know, into that character. And then if I'm writing kind of the semi, you know, kind of, I won't, for lack of a better word, kind of the big evil corporation that's kind of running the whole galaxy, then I can put a little of my personality into that that goes like, you know, yeah, I think, you know, having control over everything where you don't have to worry about anything that, you know, you don't want to have happen, that, you know, organizing things where, you know, you have, you know, where you're de-risking your own life and the world around you, like, can make sense as well. So I think, you know, you're finding elements that you can kind of believe in to bring to these different characters, even if at the end of the day, like my, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say I would like for us to all be, you know, ruled by a single giant corporation, but that's a way into those characters in the way that I think is going to be believable for the person that reads it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was thinking about too, how interesting it is, kind of like what you just said, that, you know, each one of us has just different parts of our personality, but I think as a collective, sometimes, like, there's like, different movements, and we see it with political movements and stuff like that, but, like, sometimes there's, like, a thing that you can tap into that a lot of people are feeling, but maybe they're not talking about, you know? You can put in a story.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and I think some of our, you know, some of the best movies and shows and, you know, things that we like, you know, they're saying something without overtly saying the thing that they're saying. Like, you know, the theme of a movie or the theme of a show is often, you know, at a high level, it might be, you know, everyone should be treated equally, but you're not having characters necessarily say those words, you know, on screen. It's like the story could be completely about something. It could be two dogs going on an adventure together, but the theme or the message of the story could be, you know, about, you know, not judging a book by its cover, let's say. So, you know, I think it is actually important also kind of sometimes think about, like, what are you trying to say? You know, what is the, you know, I hate to say the message, but what is the kind of the theme or the tone or the, you know, the thing that you hope people will take away from this underneath the surface, let's say.
And with Dead Town, I think you obviously were an executive producer. And I wanted to ask, what is it like, what's the difference here? And how much responsibility in managing does that take to be a producer on a project?
Yeah.
As opposed to just like,
yeah.
Well, I don't want to say just, you know what I mean.
Oh, no, totally. So yeah, I mean, for Dead Town, it's a little different because that is kind of Adam and my baby as well. So like, you know, we write it, we created it, like, you know, we're producing it, but it's, we're very involved in the minutiae of it because it's really our thing. There are many other projects within Macroverse where we really are functioning more, you know, just as the producers. And so in that scenario, it's like, you know, we're essentially bringing the team together and then kind of just participating in the process. And there are times, depending on, you know, where we are in production or kind of what stage things are at, where we may chime in and say, you know, okay, I think this is working really well over here, but let's revisit, you know, this part of the story. Or, you know, in the case where art is coming in, you know, more often than not, it's me going like, okay, this is great. And, you know, this is a little confusing. And so for me, like most of what I would say I do, once we've kind of assembled the team and we've kind of got stuff up and running. So that's kind of step one, is just getting the right people in the right places to, you know, have something start moving. And then I think if we've done our job right, it's much like casting actors for live action. It's like, you know, people don't realize how much casting is the critical piece of the end result of something that involves actors. It's much less about directing the performance most of the time, and it's much more about just having the right person in that role. And so same thing when it comes to creating comics or you know, any of these other mediums. If you can find the right people to fill these different roles in the creative process, then most of the work is done. And then it's really just helping that get up and run. And, you know, now people are kind of moving and in production and they're doing their work. And then the job that, you know, we take on as producers is just making sure that things get across the finish line, that we're there to help if anything comes up, that we can weigh in with concerns or ideas as we start to see things come in. And then a lot of it is just like, great job, keep going. and then, you know, I will say the last thing for our platform in particular is, you know, we've invented a, you know, kind of digital comics format. And so once we have all the work in, then myself and Steven, who's both the artist on Deadtown and also the head of our production for putting all this stuff together in our format, you know, then we'll also work together on just, you know, getting that kind of final stage ready to launch into our app and onto our platform and all that good stuff.
I do have questions about some other things like Macroverse. I had a question about Kickstarter. Sure. But I did want to ask about, so let's say, is there advice that you would give for people listening to this, writers who are saying, okay, I like Evan's story. It's very interesting. I like how he got into it. And they want to know, is there anything that they could do now? You know, to maybe they want to be a comic book writer or they want to be, you know, a game writer or something. How do they get into it from where they're at?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this applies across the board. Like this, it sounds easy, and I realize that the gulf between what it sounds like and what it takes to actually do it can feel larger than, you know, certainly on that side of it than on this side of it. But I do have those, you know, very clear memories of the struggle at times. but I think the fundamental thing at the end of the day, and I would just plant this in your mind and keep coming back to it, is that I don't think you can create or learn theoretically. I think you have to actually do something. You have to make something. And so kind of circling back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, we are in a moment in time where the ability to make something and put it out, whether that's on social media or ultimately through Kickstarter or Patreon or, you know, any of the dozens of platforms that are out there to allow for people to build an audience, connect with an audience, ultimately get supported by an audience. You know, we've just never had that access, you know, in a way that's been greater than it is today. And so, you know, I think if you've got an idea for something, don't make it too big. I think it gets overwhelming if you're just getting started and you're like, I'm going to make a, you know, 50 issue comic series, you know, or I'm going to, you know, make my own Marvel universe. Like, you know, don't make it too big. Start with something very small and contained and doable. I'm going to write an 8-page comic. I'm going to write a 3-page comic, you know, and then find an artist. Even if it's someone that you find on social media or it's someone that you hire off of Fiverr, even if it's not fully professional quality work, but just going through the process of, I wrote this script, I found an artist, they created the art for it, I scripted it, we put it together with word balloons, we put it out on the internet. Like that, we will learn so much just doing that process of getting something out of your head onto paper into reality. And then do it again, you know, and I think that's really the only way to do it is, you know, we do live in a world now again, where you can just, you know, create these things, put them out, get feedback, iterate, continue to find your own approach, your own voice, your own way of, you know, doing these things. And that's how you'll get there. And I think, you know, you see more and more now where, you know, with comics as one example, it used to be, you know, before I went to art school, I had sent, you know, maybe 5 or 6 different packages of samples to Marvel, and I've got some awesome rejection letters from them. And that was a, you know, you would go to a comic convention or you would send in your samples and you would show, you know, in the case of creating artwork, you'd go, you know, here are my pages, you'd get feedback, and you would just be hoping that an editor would go like, I want you to come draw, you know, Spider-Man or, you know, whatever it is. You know, and so I actually had that happen once with right before I went to art school. If people remember Malibu Comics, I had done some samples for them. Went to the last comic convention before I was about to start college and got offered a job at Malibu and actually turned it down to go to art school, which ultimately was the right decision. But, you know, nowadays that wouldn't be the way to do it. Now it would be make your own comic. And then once you've got an issue of a comic or even a, you know, a short comic, like that becomes the thing that you show people. Cause it's actually much more impressive to the people that you would want to be working with that you've had the drive, determination, ability, willingness to, you know, take this thing from start to finish rather than, you know, the idea of, you know, here's some thoughts on paper, or here's me kind of talking about something that I would like to do. So I think that is really the biggest advice I can give to anyone that wants to make anything, is just make the smallest version of it and then make another one and then make another one and then make another one. And you'll shock yourself with how much progress you'll have over the course of 6 months or a year, you know, just by going through that process.
That was really good advice. So I also wanted to ask, I saw, okay, when you go to Macroverse and some of the projects say they were fully funded on Kickstarter and stuff like that. How important do you think Kickstarter is, and like, how did you guys learn that skill? Because for some reason, I do believe Kickstarter, like putting together a good Kickstarter, is a skill. And just can you chat a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I wish I had a much better answer for this. This is just, there are people that I hope you'll have on the show that really could truly answer that in a meaningful way for your audience. This is just where, you know, we've been in this industry now for 20 plus years. So, you know, in our case, the first Kickstarter that we did was this project with the creators of Robot Chicken. So, you know, already has some kind of credibility and cachet kind of coming into the project. And then we've got a collaborator who has done a bunch of really successful Kickstarters. And so he was able to kind of guide us, you know, through that process. So I personally cannot, you know, claim to be a master at Kickstarter. That said, there are a number of creators that we work with who have done incredibly well on Kickstarter and have kind of have essentially created their whole careers off of Kickstarter. And I always point to Jason Brubaker, who creates a series called Remind, and then we've got a bunch of others coming onto the platform as well. But Jason was a concept artist on the first Kung Fu Panda movies. He was one of the early pioneers in webcomics, so like one of the first webcomics that got like 1 million views, you know, just on the web as a page at a time, you know, posting on a website, you know, now 15 years ago or so. And then he was a very early adopter of Kickstarter. And so I think, you know, he really benefited from being one of the first kind of really professional looking, you know, comic graphic novel projects on Kickstarter. And he's been able to, you know, successfully fund all of his graphic novels through Kickstarter and kind of build his audience through that. So, you know, I think as with all these platforms, the more successful the platform becomes, it gets a little harder to kind of break through the noise and get the attention that you're trying to get. I think what I can say, no matter whether you're looking at Kickstarter or Indiegogo or Patreon or kind of any of the platforms that allow you to fund projects, is that, you know, it all comes back to building an audience in the community, you know, one way or another. So, you know, what Jason did very specifically is he spent a lot of time creating YouTube content. And so he was, you know, sharing a lot of his process and, you know, doing kind of teaching things that he felt he had learned as far as creating comics and creating indie comics in particular. As he started publishing his own work, he would do whole video series on, you know, what did it take to learn how to do that? What were the problems that he ran into? What were the challenges that he had? So I think a lot of sharing the process is a good way to start to connect with people that are interested and kind of also going through the same challenges. And then I think, you know, what I've heard, what I, again, this is not my personal experience, but what I've heard from a lot of people that have gone through that kind of real startup on Kickstarter, you know, process, is, you know, don't rush it and be prepared for a really intense month of running the campaign. Cause it is truly like you're not just putting it up and it's just going to magically fund. Like, you've got to be talking to people and promoting it and, you know, essentially marketing the campaign in every way that you can to just have people find it and decide if they want to back it, especially as kind of the first few that you do. So we will be doing some more on Kickstarter as Macroverse over this year, but, you know, I think it's not fair for me to say that we didn't have a little bit of a leg up just based on the people that were involved.
Yeah. And then can you share about Macroverse, because I think it's so interesting. I have a few detailed questions.
Yeah.
But just for like the future of comics in general and for what you guys are building, it just seems so, okay, from my perspective, it seems so big. But I'd love to hear just from tell us about it.
It's very ambitious. There's no doubt about it. So, you know, if you haven't heard about what we're doing yet, I'll try to do the short version of kind of what it is. So Macroverse is a next generation entertainment company. Right now we're focused on comics very specifically, and we can talk about kind of why that is. I think the short version of why start with comics, you know, we've done all these other things. We could have tried to start making TV shows or, you know, making games or doing animation. Like, you know, we have the skill sets, but why start a new company focused on comics? Two things. One is we love comics. And number two, I think, you know, for those of us that have ambitions to want to create things across a bunch of other mediums, the challenges that we started to see in the entertainment industry as a whole are kind of found as a microcosm in the comics industry. And so while we felt it would be very challenging to kind of take on Netflix, as all of the other studios have been finding, you know, we felt like we could figure out a lot of the processes, the way of working with an audience and a fan base, which is a little unique to how we approach a lot of these things, that doing that in the context of comics would allow us to move faster, allow us to iterate more, and allow us to kind of figure out some of these challenges that we could then apply to other media as the company grows. And so, you know, we basically put out two products and then a ton of content, you know, through our platform. So we started as a traditional mobile app that is, you know, out on iOS and Android right now. Anyone listening to this, please go download it. It's very cool. And that started with the, you know, I touched on this earlier, the invention of what we think is the first digitally native format for comics. And so anyone that's experienced a digital comic, generally you've seen it in one of two ways. You've seen it as a PDF on an iPad, essentially, or you've seen it as the endless scroll, which is kind of a webtoon type of experience where essentially you're just scrolling a web page and it's a long, essentially one long page that you're, you know, scrolling through. And so we felt like there were shortcomings in both of those formats. And we spent a lot of time figuring out, like, what does digital allow you to do that you can't do anywhere else? Like, what, again, this is sort of that same thought process we touched on earlier of, like, what does this uniquely let you do so that you're leaning into something that is only possible in this medium, not trying to make it be something else? And that's what we kind of, especially the PDF on an iPad, is just like, you know, you're taking a physical thing and putting it on a digital device. Like, that's never been a good experience in any category. So, you know, what we ultimately realized is that the one thing digital does is eliminate the page size. Like, that's really the one thing that it uniquely does different than print, than a web page, than, you know, anything else. It's like, you don't have to be constrained by the size of the screen or the size of a physical dimension of a page, of an object. And so once you eliminate the page size, then you can start to think about storytelling in a different way. And so our solution to that is, every time you tap the screen, something changes. It's a very, very simple mechanic. But as creators and storytellers, now you can think about, how is the quote unquote camera working in this sequence? You know, you can introduce time as an element of storytelling into a comic, where if it takes 3 taps to go from point A to point B in the story, that's one experience. If it takes 30 taps to go from point A to point B, that has a very different feel to it. So being able to compress and extend the way that you flow through a sequence in a feeling of time. There's something kind of magical that happens just by tapping the screen, where you feel like you're all of a sudden really a part of the storytelling as a reader. You have this kind of connection to being in control of the way that the story unfolds, which is pretty unique. And there's a bunch more that, when we, you know, we work with creators, we kind of talk about, like, what do we think we've learned about how this works and how you can utilize this medium to its fullest extent. But fundamentally, we just, you know, we spent a lot of time figuring out what we thought that format was. And then once we figured that out, you know, the next question was like, is there a business here? once we decided that we thought there was, then that's when we launched the mobile app. And so at this point, you know, we've worked with about 100 different series, about 1,000 different episodes of content are up on the app. There's a ton more coming over this year and kind of ongoingly. And we've also built a structure around the app for creators, which we think is the best in the industry as far as how independent comics creators and even larger publishers can monetize their digital comics content, you know, in a way that no one else is doing. So there's a lot on the mobile side, but fundamentally, it's just about a better experience for consuming, you know, this content, for people to be able to access great stories. And then the platform that we just launched, the kind of big expansion to that we launched just before the end of last year, is something we've been building for the last 2 years, which is a real milestone for me personally to go, like, we finally got this out. And that is the first digital collectible comics format. And so, you know, utilizing some blockchain technology, you're able to actually own digital versions of your favorite series and new series that, you know, is kind of I like to think of it as kind of like the Criterion Collection, you know, edition of these, you know, favorite graphic novels. And so we started with 5 series. We've got about 40 more in various stages of production that'll come out over the next year or so. And then we'll keep building on it from there. So, you know, the real ambition is to kind of rethink how our big franchises, big entertainment franchises, created and how are they built. And beyond the technology piece of it, you know, we really care a lot about how creators are treated, how creators are rewarded for things that connect with an audience, and how an audience, how fans, me being one of those, can play a role in the development of these things. And so, you know, I'll pause here momentarily. I could talk about this literally for like 3 hours, but, you know, we are very excited about the future of media in general being something that isn't just me telling you a story and you either like it or you don't, but me creating some framework that we then both get to participate in, and in different ways. So in a sense, it's like, if I could go create my own Star Wars comics with Lucasfilm's blessing, and assuming I hit some kind of quality bar, they go, great. And then, you know, we both get to benefit from that without having to go, like, pitch them a full series and go through 10 layers of executives and, like, you know, all the things that you would have to do in a traditional media context. That's part of what all this is. It's like the ability for people to come bring their creativity to these things that we've, you know, kind of put in place, these playgrounds that we're kind of opening up for people to come play in. And so as a fan, you can own characters in these worlds. You can tell stories with those characters in these worlds. We'll support that both, you know, emotionally and creatively, and in some cases, you know, financially as well, helping people create these things in canon, in these larger franchises that we're building. And we believe that this kind of, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it, a kind of a Roblox model for entertainment is what's going to evolve. And we think we're kind of at the forefront of that.
So, like, with owning a digital comic and like having it with blockchain, do you think in the future there could be fun things like, okay, if you own this and you have it in your wallet, then that's also like your ticket to this event that we're putting on and stuff?
100%. Yeah, I mean, the question often comes up, like, why blockchain? You know, and I always like to say, like, you know, I'm always looking for, like, what are the new technologies that give you things that you couldn't do before? Because if it's not giving you something genuinely new, then why bother? So it's like, you know, what are the superpowers that this technology unlocks? And so there are really two things that I think, two reasons to build these things on a blockchain. One is the blockchain is the only way to actually truly own a digital thing. So, you know, my daughter's 10 years old. I always like to say she's our chief futurist because I'm just a total, you know, student of how she consumes pop culture and content. And I fully believe it's this window into the world of like, what is the next generation of people that we would like to connect with and make stuff for, you know, going to look like. And so, you know, she is a Roblox addict. And, you know, what I find fascinating is that it's not just playing games the way that I used to play games and still do play games. But she's much more interested in the cross section of experiences that she can have around characters and franchises that she responds to. And so, you know, she's very into this book series called Wings of Fire. It's this, you know, very, you know, this dragon story. And so she's got the, you know, the chapter books and she's got the graphic novels. And now there's a experience in Wings of Fire in Roblox. And so she'll play around in that. And what's fascinating about that is a lot of these Roblox experiences are more, I would say more social, less game. Like it's more role play than it is, you know, go slay the villain and, you know, level up. And so there's a fascinating component to that. But what I find so interesting and have become convinced by is that her whole generation is going to wake up 10 years from now and say, oh, that all that stuff that mom and dad bought me in Roblox with Robux, all that stuff that, you know, all this money got, you know, put into, I can't do anything with that. Like, I don't own any of that. I can't, you know, even give it away to somebody else, like, you know, when I'm done with it. And I think there's this going to kind of be this mass awakening of this next generation who spends more and more and more and more time in the digital world. And like, why don't I own these things? Like, I paid for this. Why can't I do anything with this? And so that's what a blockchain allows you to do, is allows you to own these things and then be able to do things with them. Like, I could give something to you, or I could resell it for not necessarily even a profit, but just to recover some of what I put into it to then be able to buy something else. So just being able to have the things that we do in the physical world translate into the digital world, there really is no other good way to do that outside of having these things registered on a blockchain. So that's kind of number one. And then back to what you said initially is that, yeah, I think the other incredibly cool thing is that because it's decentralized, meaning that it's not just, these things don't just live in our own database. They live in this kind of open, permissionless ledger that anyone can see, you know, on the blockchain. And so not only could I say, oh, you own these, you know, two epic editions, which was, you know, what we call our collectible editions. You own these two epics. Therefore, as an early supporter of what we're building, I can give you some other cool stuff or some cool access or some perks and rewards and those sorts of things. But the other kind of cool thing is I could go, oh, you know, maybe DC Comics has decided to start minting some comics on the blockchain. And by the way, they have. So that's not a made up scenario. But I could go to anyone that's collected DC Comics on the blockchain and say, you know, I can see all of those wallet addresses. And I'd say anyone that's got, you know, any of these Batman editions, let's come give you some kind of special perk and reward inside of Macroverse as well. So it becomes this very interesting new way of being able to connect with fans, to connect with the same type of, you know, collectors or people that you, you know, might like to try to find your way into. And rather than me, you know, putting Facebook ads in front of people that like comics and hoping that they respond to what we're doing, we could actually do something meaningful and say, like, if you collected from these things from DC, let us give you something cool over here in Macroverse. And, you know, there's all kinds of different ways that that plays out over time. But, you know, I think it does open some doors that were very challenging, if not impossible, you know, before.
I just had a question from what you said, which, so I want to go back for a minute. So yeah. People can make their own characters.
Yeah.
But, and like that whole character is something that they've made within the, larger story. Yeah. And like what you're saying is that character is theirs.
Correct.
They own that character.
Yeah.
And like all the things that building a character comes with, that's theirs. That just blew my mind for a minute. I'm like, wait a minute.
This is what I think is so cool. Yeah. So I, you know, this is the part I've fallen in love with that I wouldn't have been able to predict, you know, 3 years ago. So the way I look at this is, you know, anyone that has followed the world of NFTs at all, like, you know, it's been a real roller coaster. There's some real positive elements of NFTs. There's some real negative elements of kind of what the NFT culture has kind of become. And I think the way we look at it is like 5 years from now, none of that's going to matter. These are just cool things that live in the digital world that we can do things with. And so that's our approach now, is like, how do we get people not engaged in the speculative side of the market, but how do we get people engaged in, I like characters and stories. And so being able to do more with characters and stories is appealing to me. And so what we kind of oriented around is, if we have these worlds, which we call these kind of larger franchises. So we've talked about Dead Town. I'll use Dead Town as the example, because it's also one that's live right now. So we have this, you know, kind of dual track inside of Dead Town. There's this main storyline, which Adam and I write, that Steven draws, that you can collect, you know, epic editions of at macroverse.com right now, shameless plug. And so, you know, those are available to buy and collect and mint, you know, right now. And you've got the main story. So there's, you know, 10 episodes in season one that, you know, tell the first part of the kind of core storyline that we wrote and created. We also created what we call character collection, what, you know, a lot of the rest of the NFT world calls PFPs, or profile picture collection. So these are kind of bust up, you know, characters within this world. In the case of Dead Town, they're all zombies. And what we saw in the larger kind of NFT Web3 space is a lot of these character collections or PFPs were coming out, and they are just randomized. So it's really just a slot machine. It's like, you know, pull the lever, hope I get something good. And then for a lot of people, hope I can resell it, you know, for a profit. And because we were more interested in creating some sort of emotional connection to these characters, we approached it a different way, which was like more like a video game avatar system. And so you can come to our Dead Town avatar creator, to our character creator, completely customize your own, you know, zombie character. Getting back to the, you know, what can you do on the blockchain? We can recognize, you know, if you've got something from a different collection that we like, we've put some specific elements in there that you can only get if you've got that. So there's some kind of cool, you know, exclusives and things like that, as partner rewards or perks. But let's say you create your own, you know, zombie character. You mint that character, so you now put that onto the blockchain. At that moment, that character is now provably yours. Like, you've bought this, you've minted it, you own this character. And then we had to do a lot with attorneys to figure out exactly how to make this all make sense, you know, from a legal perspective. But basically how it works is, now you own that character, you can do anything you want. If you want to go make a, you know, t-shirt with that zombie character, you can do that. If you want to open a barbecue restaurant that features your zombie as the mascot, you can do that as well. So, you know, whatever you want to do, commercial rights, anything with that character. The only thing you can't do by yourself is say that this is a Dead Town, you know, story. So you can't go by yourself and make, you know, you can do fan fiction all day long, but you can't do something that we're going to say this is canonical. We're going to use it in the larger storyline. It's going to be in the larger world. However, because we want to break down these gatekeeper barriers, if you come to us in Discord or through our other channels and say, hey, this is my character and here's their story and this is the idea that I have for them. And we even have this built into our website where you can submit stories, you know, through the website with your character. So you come and you participate, you come and you do something with us, with that character. And you say, you know, this is the story that I want to tell. This is where they occupy some space in this world. Then we get very excited about that. We go, awesome, like let's get into that. And so over the course of what we kind of consider seasons, we'll do this, you know, multiple times. The first batch of Dead Town stories have happened at this point. So there's been 8 characters so far, which have gone through this process where people have pitched their stories. Both we as the creators of Dead Town and the larger community get to weigh in on which one of the submissions, you know, get quote unquote greenlit and become canon. And then we do a couple things with the ones that get greenlit. One is the NFTs themselves actually get upgraded. So they become this kind of new type of dynamic NFT where you can see, but the character that you created, Steven, the artist, goes and creates a unique piece of artwork that represents your character now as a canonical piece of the universe, which also gets added back into the NFT. And then you get a couple of other things. So within the collection, these 8 greenlit characters so far are the most unique characters in the collection. They are also now real characters in the world. So you could think of this as like, you know, a Boba Fett or a, you know, a Deadpool within the X-Men universe. Like they're not necessarily the main characters, but they are now real characters in this universe. And then what comes along with that green light is we will now work with you to produce the first short story for that character. So far these have been in Dead Town, 8-page stories. We bring in professional artists. We work with you to create the, you know, the script if necessary. And, you know, the end result of that is now we have an 8-episode anthology series, which, you know, are these different character stories inside of this universe that gets released out through our apps and ultimately through the platform. And then as the owner of that character, the little trade-off that we're making is, you know, now that that character is canon, we're saying, okay, now you can't now necessarily go do whatever you want with the character because now they live in the larger world, but we're partners now. And so that means that anything that happens that has a positive outcome with that character, let's say you do create the next Deadpool and Deadpool, you know, your character within Dead Town goes on to have its whole own spinoff series, which we would love to have happen. Then you get a piece of that as well. So you get royalties, you get, you know, residuals, you get, you know, anything that happens with that character across any medium for all eternity, you know, goes back to you as the creator and owner of that character. And so I think this is a really unique way of being able to, you know, kind of have our cake and eat it too, where it's like, we still get to tell the story that we want to tell, but we've built this playground for other creators to come in and be collaborative and, you know, build out corners of the world that we would never think of, that we would never get to, that other people might even like better. So, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity there to play.
That is so awesome. I'm just like, that just made me so excited for everything. I don't know. That is so cool. I don't know if I totally understood that the first time that we talked, but now that I feel like I understand it better, and I'm just like thinking all these different things. Like, it's so amazing. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Well, thank you. You got to start thinking about some zombie characters.
Yeah, I was like, wait a minute, I'm going to have to get in there. So I also had a question about you when you had talked about, so your daughter likes Wings of Fire, or I don't know the actual book, but that might be what you had mentioned. And so there was all these different things. Do people come to you and they say, okay, we know it's digital, but we also, like, we're going to pitch a story to you. We want to do digital, but we'd also like to do print. Do you have people that do that? Or do you say, no, we're just doing digital because this is the future?
Yeah, no, I think print is definitely still a part of the comics industry. There's no doubt about that. So, I mean, it's actually one of the things we announced is that we haven't said who the partner is yet, but we put together a print publishing partnership this past year. And so we will start to have stuff come out in traditional comic and bookstores, you know, starting this year and on into the future. So I think, you know, the broader thesis that we have is that it's not digital versus print. It's just that I think the future is digital and collectible. And collectible doesn't just mean digital collectible, although I think that's a big part of it. But I think there's still an appetite and an interest, including for me, in kind of beautiful collectible things. And so, you know, I think we care less about, you know, kind of the individual floppy issues, even though we still might put some of those out because there's, you know, there is a certain segment of people that would like to have them and why not give them to them. But I think the longer term thesis that we have is that, you know, it's either digital experiences connected to these digital, you know, objects and things that you can own and participate in. Or it's, you know, these kind of beautiful collectible editions of things that you might be excited to have, you know, behind you on your bookshelf or on your coffee table, or, you know, kind of the more premium kind of print side of things. And so we've got a bunch of things that are kind of in the works around that as well. But I think it actually makes us the only digital company that is also able to kind of do that 360, which is kind of interesting and kind of cool. And I think as we talked about being able to tie in, you know, other things because of the blockchain, I think there will be some interesting things that we can do actually across digital and print experiences, which will be fun for people too.
Awesome. Well, that's all the questions that I had today, but I wanted to thank you. And if you can let us know, I'll put macroverse.com down below. I know you're on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, I think the two places, I mean, I'm always available for people to come and chat. So, you know, you are, of course, always welcome. But anyone that hears this is also more than welcome to come and say hi and connect. I mean, both. I'm most active on social media on Twitter. So me personally is at Ebonverse, Macroverse is at Macroverse. And then our Discord is discord.gg/Macroverse. And if you're interested in kind of the creative storytelling, world building side of all of this, like that's the best place to come and hang out. We've got a very cool community of people that are, you know, kind of engaged in all of this stuff. And many of them have gone through this process that we've talked about, who actually have these characters that have been greenlit into these different, you know, worlds. And it's a very collaborative, very supportive group of people. So you'd be more than welcome to come say hi there. And if you have more questions for me, I'm pretty available for that as well.